I'm going to do something to you tonight. I'm going to give you this little homework assignment. And in this, I know you're going like, hey, I didn't sign up for homework. I am going to give you this little homework assignment, though. It's going to take you 2 weeks to do, because we're not going to talk about the Pax Romana until next week. It is going to count as a part of your exam, and it's going to be 25% of your exam. So just answer these in full, just essay. I mean, they don't short answer essay kind of things. There'll be 25% of your exam in there, take home. I'll give them to you now, and you can start, and as we're talking, you can kind of, if you want to jot down some stuff, or, there you go. Okay, tonight, like I said, we want to, okay, ugh, the Etruscans and the Latins and the Romans, okay, we're going to talk about the origins of Rome, how it got started, what it was like, what the main conflicts in Rome were. And now all of this is before Christ. We're going to bring you right about up to, well, we're going to bring you up to Julius Caesar tonight. I don't know if Julius Caesar will be crossing the Rubicon tonight. He'll either cross it tonight or he'll cross it next Monday night. But Julius Caesar, that's okay, just leave it there. He crosses the Rubicon and becomes the first emperor of Rome. And all kinds of neat things happen, okay? So, that's it. I guess we ought to probably get started. Let's open up with a word of prayer. How many here are tired tonight? Good, I don't feel so bad. We'll try to get you out of here 5 or 6 minutes early. This is America. No, it's not. You're only kidding me. This is nothing, looks nothing like Spain, but let's make believe it is. Spain, and the west coast of Spain is? Portugal. You don't see many Portuguese people around these parts, but there are quite a few of them in America. This is also known as Ferreira Amaral. What else? And Pavo and Sousa land. Yeah, these are the primary tribes. We're not gonna do Portuguese history though. Okay, I'm just having fun. This is obviously, what else could it be, but Greece, right? This is Sicily right here. Just call her Sis. And down here is Crete. And we'll go over here like this. And all right, we don't even have to go that far anymore. Asia Minor. And this is... We're making the Mediterranean here. This is the Med. This is the Med, and this is Africa. Now, we should be careful to put over here on the tip of Africa this kind of thing here. Doesn't look anything like this. This is a place called Carthage, North Africa. That's going to be important tonight. Can we see it? Yeah, well, let me point it out to you. You see where, after the break, I'll get this map thing set up. Right here is Africa, right? Here's the Mediterranean. You can see how unbelievably mine looks just like this. Here is Italy, here's Greece, here's Crete, here's Sicily. And you see where Africa juts up like this, modern day Tunis? Right here, that's ancient Carthage, okay? That's going to be important tonight because the Romans fight three wars with the Carthaginians known as the Punic Wars. Those of you that are into guns are going to love what I have to say about Carthage tonight, because you're going to see that Carthage learned a lesson in history. Never disarm, because when you disarm, you will lose. And Julius Caesar had it right on the money when he said, let those who would desire peace prepare for war. Knowing that the only way that you ever maintain peace as a nation in the world is when you're so strong that nobody's going to mess with you. Okay, so wish the Democrats had figured that out. Now, there's a river here called the Tiber River. Let's just make believe it's here. It's not. It's down here somewhere. This is the Tiber River. And on the Tiber River, there's a place, let's call it Rome, because that's its name. And... there's a bunch of early people that inhabited the Italian peninsula. We think of Rome. Where did these people come from? You know what? We don't really know. There was an early group of people here. Well, first of all, if you keep going north up here, what do you get into right here? Who knows? Who knows the geography?
France.
But what was France called in the ancient world? Who knows?
Gaul.
Gaul. Excellent. Gaul. So the Gaulish people, the Gaelic people, not to be confused with the Gaelic people in like Celtic land, you know, up in the British Isles, but the Celtic people, they inhabited a portion of this area in here. Now, we're basically dealing with this, folks. On the west side, we're basically dealing, there's not going to be much happening over here for a while. It's basically on the west side of the Italian peninsula, okay? Okay, there's a group of people here called the Etruscans. And this is already getting heavy for a Monday night, huh? There's a group of people here called the Etruscans who occupied northern Italy, the Etruscans. There's another group of people here in central Italy called the, who knows? Do you know? No. The Latins. I didn't know if you had this in world history. The Latins, okay? Lots of tribes. You know what? Let's put Rome over here. Okay? It's easier for me to change it than it is for you, huh? That's okay. I don't even feel bad. Now, here's the other thing. In Greece, Greece is colony crazy. They're colonizing everything. They have these Greek city-states, which are called polises. Here's Ionia. They, you know that they're in here everywhere. Ancient Troy was over here up near the Hellespont. They have colonies everywhere, okay, on all the major islands. Well, the Greeks also came in, and the Greeks settled Sicily in a big way. C-S-I-S, like that, something like that. No, that's not right, is it?
No.
All right, forget it then. Sicily. And they settled it, but the Greeks settled in here. All these city-states everywhere, okay? And also part of the boot here, okay, like right here. This was also settled by Greece. So it became known as Gracia Minor. Gracia, G-R-A-E-C. I have the spelling here. Let me get the right spelling for you. G-R-A-E-C-I-A. G-R, where am I? G-R-A-E-C-I-A. Oh, I'm sorry, Magna Gracia, okay? Magna Gracia, which means greater Greece. They had the Greater Greece World Outreach here too, by the way. Just so, in case you didn't know that. Greater Greece World Outreach, it was right here. Never heard it before, never seen it before, it's right here. First time, right? Okay. Greater Greece, I never heard of it, like I never thought of that before, that's a good one. Okay, so you have these tribes in here, okay? Now, eventually, what happens, folks, is these people, these are a bunch of tribes. I don't know how you want to think of it. It's kind of confusing. The Latins are a bunch of tribes, and they start some various little cities. And one of the cities that they start is Rome. And Rome becomes the most important of all the cities. The Etruscan people that live there are also very important. Probably, and I want you to see this, civilization, the Romans are great borrowers. They borrow everything. They borrowed the theater from the Greeks. They borrowed many of the Greek gods, not only Greek gods, but Etruscan gods. Everywhere. They borrowed gods from everywhere. Everywhere they found a new god, they took them. And also, so much of the culture, their dress, their religion, their clothing, everything that they basically did, a lot of it was taken from the Greek culture. The Hellenistic culture that was spread around the world by Alexander the Great. Now, how did the Etruscans become, well, Hellenized? How did they become Hellenized? How did they learn the Greek culture? It probably came from Greece to the colonies, okay, up through Magna Graecia to the Etruscans to the Latins, You get the idea? Let me write this little progression down. Greek culture spread like this. I have a little list. From the Greeks to Magna Gratia to the Etruscans to the Romans. Now, we say the Romans. Who are the Romans? The Romans are the Latins. There's a group of Latin tribes that get together and they found this city called Rome, which will become the most important and the most powerful of all the Greek city-states. So, the Roman city-states. So the idea is Rome is going to be incredibly powerful, and eventually the first thing that's going to happen is the Romans are going to, if you might want to just jot these down as like 1, 2, 3, you know, that kind of thing. And I'll try to keep them straight in my mind as I tell them to you. First of all, the Romans are going to conquer the Etruscans. The Romans conquer the Etruscans. Or let's say the Latins who are in Rome conquer the Etruscans. Okay? Second, they form a league together. The Latin tribes form a league together with Rome as the leader. The Latin tribes form a league together with Rome as the leader. Next, the Romans, this group of tribes, conquer the rest of the league. So they drive out the Etruscans, then they eventually drive out the Latins. They conquer the Latins and they dissolve the league. Then, where do you think they're going next, folks? Right, sure, Magna Gratia, right? So down they come south into Magna Gratia, and they're conquering these people. Now, at this point, let's plug in one guy. Let me kind of make this a little neater here now. Everybody kind of understand where we are, what we're doing here? All right. That is some boot. Rome's over here, okay, Rome. Roma. And it's important that we say Roma, because that was the name of the city-state. It was named by Romulus, who murdered his brother for jumping over a ditch. Well, I'll tell you the story in a minute. I have the little story. This is the cleaned-up kiddies version. I'll tell you how bloodthirsty the real one was. Here's Roma, okay, Roma. Aroma is a smell. Don't confuse the two, okay? Aroma is... No, that's no good. Okay. That's no good. Okay, now watch this. What are we talking about? Okay, the Latins come down and they conquer the Magna Gratia, okay? Now, there's a guy... These people in Magna Gratia, let's call it MG, okay? Magna Gratia. They say they go to the king over here who's got a name called... Don't yawn, Paul. It's too early. His name is Pyrrhus. Pyrrhus from Epirus. That was his name, but Pyrrhus, like that. Okay? Pyrrhus. He's the king, king of the Greeks. Pyrrhus. You know what? There's an H here, too. Before the U. Pyrrhus, like that. So Pyrrhus, for a while, sends some reinforcements, and he wins a couple of victories over the Romans, okay? We're calling them Romans now because they've conquered all the other Latin tribes. So now they're the Romans. The Roman tribe of the Latins is now dominating, okay? Hey, you think it's hard to understand it? Try teaching it. Now, this isn't Mr. G. This is Magna Gratia. Pyrrhus sends some reinforcements, and he does bang out a couple of victories here, but they're called Pyrrhic victories. Have you ever heard of a Pyrrhic victory before? It's a famous term in military history. Let me write it down for you, because it's pretty interesting to note at this, as George Bush would say, at this juncture. Pyrrhic, like that, victory. Okay, you know what a Pyrrhic victory is? A Pyrrhic victory is when you win the battle, but you lose most of your army doing it. They won these battles, but they suffered unbelievable amounts of casualties. So it's almost like, did we win the battle? Was it worth winning the battle for the incredible dent it put in the army? That's what a Pyrrhic victory is. So, but Pyrrhus is eventually overthrown, and the Romans are now in control of the whole boot, and the rock too. Okay? Everybody with us so far? Oh, I'm sorry, I don't mean to do this to you either. Okay, let me see, we're done with that? All right. They borrowed their gods from, as I said, from various different locations. They borrowed their gods from the Etruscans, from the Greeks, from the Persians, and from the Egyptians. They kind of had a hodgepodge of gods and goddesses. Anybody know what the Pantheon is? Not the Parthenon, the Pantheon. The Pantheon is this huge dome. In fact, the largest dome ever built in antiquity. The largest dome... Oh, you know, I have to tell you the story of Brunelleschi and how Brunelleschi made the dome in Florence. Anybody ever hear that story? Who's Brunelleschi? What's a dome? Where's Florence? Let me go forward here, just because this is such a great story, I don't want to miss it. And it's not part of our curriculum, but so maybe we won't let you out early. Here's the idea. They have this contest in the ancient world, but in the Renaissance. If you wanted to do something, like say, you know, you wanted to, someone wanted a statue carved, the artists would get together and they would say, I can do that thing for this amount of money, and I do it very nice. And the other guy would say, I can do that thing for less of money than he tell you he can do that thing, and it still look very nice. But they would have these contests. Well, they had this thing. Thing looked like this. Actually, they had a building with a hole in the top. Okay? It was a engineering blunder. But they had a hole in the top, and it was supposed to be okay, but they figured they want to cover the hole with a dome, a beautiful dome. Okay? And so they get all these architectures together. Brunelleschi, by the way, he's an architectural and artistic genius. He was one of the great artists of the Renaissance. They get together in this little this thing. They're all proposing how they're going to do the dome, and Brunelleschi says, "I'm not going to tell you how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it better than they can do it." And they said, "Well, Brunelleschi." Now they knew this guy was a master. He'd already earned himself a reputation as being absolutely magnificent, and he says, "Brunelleschi, you know, I mean." We love you. We love your work. We love your, you know, the doors and all of the things that you've done. And he's going up against this other guy, Ghiberti. Now, he says, Brunelleschi says, okay. He says, I tell you what. He says, we take this egg, and he took an egg. We take this egg, which in Italian is uova. I know because I was in Sicily, and I was thinking, what could be a more ridiculous word than egg? Whoa, that's a more ridiculous word than egg. Man, look at this. I don't even have my coat on. He said, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, the one who can make this egg stand up on its end, he do it the dome. Now, these are grown men. Grown men in a business kind of proposition. And they said, so they passed a plate with the egg, a raw egg, around the table. And they're all... Thing falls down, wobbles. All around the table, it goes, none of them can make the egg stand up on its end. So Brunelleschi says, all right, I'll show you how to do it. Brunelleschi takes the egg, and he takes it, and he goes, and he breaks the end of the egg, and he stands it up on the end like this. And they said, what's this? That's not fair. You break the egg. He goes, we could have done that. And he says, yes, and you can put the dome on the roof too, if I tell you how. Anyway, Brunelleschi got the job, and it's a masterpiece. It's one of the great stories. Okay, what's that got to do with this? I have no... Oh, the Parthenon, the Pantheon. The Parthenon was Greek. We already studied that, remember? The Pantheon, folks, gives you a good idea of what the Romans were like. The Pantheon was a building that had a huge dome on the inside, and it had a hole in the top with a light, like an eyeball in the top, where the light would come through and shine, okay? Now, all around, it was a big open area inside, and all around, there were these little niches for gods. Pan means many in Greek. Theos means God. Many gods. What they did is they said, hey, listen, instead of building a temple for every god under the sun, let's build one building, put a statue of every one of them in there. People can come in, people can come in, walk up to the god of their choice, pray to the thing, and then leave. No problem. So what they did is they made the pantheon, and they had all these niches, and in the niches they put statues of all the different gods, and they left two or three, niches with nothing in it for new gods that they would find. So that gives you an idea of where their mentality was as far as the gods and that kind of business is concerned. They were very open to that. Whenever they conquered a nation, whenever they conquered a new nation, they were much like Cyrus and the Persians. When they conquered a new nation, they were more than happy to let them worship the god that they wanted, as long as they agreed. Well, and this isn't even in the later empire. This isn't right now. I'm jumping ahead a little bit. But later on in the Roman Empire, they're going to say you can worship whatever god you want as long as you revere the emperor. Who wouldn't do that? The Jews. The Jews. See, that's the whole problem behind the Jews. The Jews, why was the temple burned? Why was Jerusalem burned in 70 AD? Because they absolutely, steadfastly refused to have any other god but Yahweh, Jehovah. Elohim, God the Father. And according to Roman law, you could have whatever gods you wanted, but you had to accept the fact that the emperor was God, and they would not accept that. So that's why Jerusalem was burned. That's why you have Masada and all those things that happened later on in history. Okay? All right, so that's just a little bit of something about their gods. They were great borrowers. Conquered peoples were allowed to worship their gods as they chose. In the early republic, they had more than one ruler. Let me make this distinction like this. What is the difference between the Roman Empire and the Roman Republic? You can write this down in your notes, and this is the best way to remember it. Okay? It wasn't when we talk about the Roman Republic, folks, we're certainly not talking about a republic like we have in the United States, and to the republic for which we stand. It's nothing like that. But this is Roman. The Roman Republic meant more than one ruler, i.e., non-monarchical. It was not a monarch. It was not one king. You know what a monarch is when you have a king? That's a monarch. The empire, this is the division, because we're going to be talking about, the Roman, the history of Rome is divided into two great sections, the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire. The only difference between the two is in the early stages, there's more than one ruler. In the later stages, it is monarchical. Meaning it had an emperor. Okay? That's the distinction that we need to make. Okay, now let's get down to business as far as what's going on inside the Roman Republic. Let's take some of this off too. Their empire is supposed to be getting bigger, and we're making it smaller. There are two classes of people inside the Roman Republic, and this is important because this is what the whole history is about. The two kinds of people are, number one, the patricians. Patricians. You know that comes from the word patra, patros, which means father. Pater. Okay, patricians. Now the patricians are from the first three tribes of Latins that settled Rome. I promised you guys big fun tonight, huh? it'll be a lot more exciting when we get to the Punic Wars. There's not much we can do here by way of excitement. That's why we threw in Brunelleschi. the egg is about as exciting as we get at this point. Okay, the patricians are composed of the first three tribes of Latins that settled Rome. Approximately 10% of the population. Now I'm going to see if anybody here is really sharp and they're on the ball. There's a second group of people. What percent do you think they make up? Anybody say 90? Oh, you're sharp. Okay. Number two, they're called the... Anybody know what they're called? The what? Hey, all right, the plebs. We don't even try to write big words like plebeians. We say plebs. The plebeians, or the plebs. Think of them as like gangs. The Sharks and the Bloods. No, don't even think of them like that. Okay, the plebs are the all others. Don't you love that, the way aristocrats, they're like, you know, we're 10% and, well, what makes someone a plebe? They're not a patrician. That's what makes them a plebe. All others, and they are common folk. Common folk. Okay? They didn't have any kind of political power at all. Atoll. They were allowed to amass as much wealth as they could, but they didn't have a whole lot of power. What they did, though, is the money that came in, they eventually are going to use that money to gain some political power. Okay? All right. Let's continue. As I said, we're going to have to go through this we're going to go through it as quickly as we can, but this is stuff we have to cover, folks. We're just not going to know what Rome's about. Everybody have this? All right. Next, let's talk a little bit about their government, and that's important, especially in the early stages. We're done with this too, right? Okay. Their government. Okay, first of all, the government is made... the government. Government. Okay. Number one, they had what was called the assembly. And it was made up of all male adult patricians. All male adult patricians. Okay. Then there was another group, folks, called the Senate. Anybody ever hear of SPQR? Senatus Populusque Romanus? Never heard that term before? All right, we'll study it next week. The Senate. The Senate was made up of ready for this word? Elite? First time I ever heard it, right here. Never heard it before. It's right here. The elite, the elite patricians. This is so important. I hope you get it. The assembly then is all male adult patricians, and then the cream of the crop, if you will, from this group are in here. Okay, you get the idea? All right. Next. A couple of things. In the early period, these guys would advise the kings. In the early period, they would advise kings. Advise kings, which were more or less figureheads than anything else. But in the later period, when there were no kings, they pretty much had an incredible amount of power. The Senate had an incredible amount of power. The third group that we have to plug in here are called the consuls. Consuls, like this. Okay? And these were two guys. I don't know what else to call them. Two guys. Who were like kings. Two guys who were like kings. They were elected for 1 year periods. Elected for 1 year periods. Okay? You can see right away, though, that something is happening in Roman in the Roman culture that we have never seen anywhere else in the world. What is it? You're beginning to get a very balanced form of government. Do you see this? This is only the roots of it. Eventually, the plebes are going to get powers, and they're going to have an assembly of their own, which is going to be equally as powerful as this assembly. And then you know what you have? You have almost a bicameral government. A bicameral government system as we have today in this country. Two houses, bicameral, meaning two-house system. We have the Senate, and we have the House of Representatives, and they check and balance one another, right? Okay, so the consuls were two guys who were like kings. I don't mean to be too technical with you tonight, but they were elected for one-year periods, and they had tremendous power. There was a fourth factor that's going to come in here, and it's called dictator. Dictator. And I don't use that word just because, you know, President Clinton's in Rhode Island. I use it because this is history, folks.
As we speak.
Even as we speak, right now, he's winning more to his side, more to the thems. The dictator was elected by, doesn't it sound weird to hear that the dictator was elected? The dictator was elected because he shot everybody who wouldn't vote for him. No, the dictator was elected by the Senate for, you know what, the dictator, let me redo this, was elected by, by recommendation, recommendation of one of the consuls. So one of these guys would say, Tony Pavo should be our new dictator.
Oh.
Elected by the recommendation of one of the consuls for a 6-month period in time of war. That's it. The only time you would have a dictator is in time of war. They were wise enough. Now, isn't this pretty incredible, folks? We're talking about, you know, 400-500 BC, and they're wise enough to realize, hey, we need checks, we need balances, we need to have an assembly with all the male patricians, then we need to have a more elite group that's going to tackle these more difficult questions called the Senate, which will be made up of the elite patricians, and we need to, somebody's got to be in charge of all these patricians, but we don't only want one guy, we want two, so they balance each other off. So they elect two consuls, but then they're also wise enough to realize, you know what, in a time of war, we need one guy to make a decision. So this guy does it. By the way, usually a military leader. Usually a military, I should say a military genius. Because the only guy that would be elected dictator would be the most qualified military general in all of Rome. Okay?
They were recommended by the dictator? The
dictator was recommended by the consuls. These are like two kings.
They recommend them, though. Who votes on it?
The Senate. Okay? The Senate would make the final decision. Now, everybody understand this?
The assembly, was that all male, or was it just made up of all male? You know what I'm saying? Was it all the male?
Oh, no. It was every male.
In every family?
Adult patrician. Patrician now. Mm-hmm. Only the 10%.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions before we move on? Now, I realize this stuff is like, you know, pulling teeth and watching grass grow and all this, but like I said, we have to cover it, so I'll apologize to you all night, though, because I'm a humble guy and I just want to have a lot of friends. Okay, next main thing that we have to cover in introduction is, oh yeah, let me give you these. Okay, so let me tell you what begins to happen here, folks. Divisions begin to happen in Rome. Now that we've kind of laid a lot of this groundwork, I can kind of we can move up a little bit. Problems are going to begin happening in Rome. Why would these problems happen? What's the most obvious thing? Yeah, you've got 90 people being controlled by the 10 who have zero to say about anything. You know, I don't think this ought to... Excuse me. Were you in one of the three founding tribes of Rome? I didn't think so. Shut up. You know, that's basically what it was. If you don't have any... I mean, if you're not a patrician, forget it. You're nothing. So... oh, boy. You know, Pastor Stewart was telling me that he's never knocked this thing off once, and I'm knocking it off.
The unit sits on the desk over there, and he's got somebody controlling it. I came in when everything...
This?
No, the unit, the bike, where it's on the floor.
Oh, really?
It's on the desk in the corner, and somebody controls it for him.
Oh, really? Wow, well, next time, we live and learn, right? Okay. Let's talk just for a minute about some of the divisions. Some of the problems that begin to happen is many of the citizens become poor, number one. Many of the citizens become poor. Number two, cheap foreign grain makes the small farmer struggle. They begin importing grain. You know, this is a problem we're still seeing today, folks, with the economy. If we can go out and get pencils from China cheaper than American workers can make it, what happens to American workers, the laborers that don't have the unskilled laborers? They're basically unemployed. So this is the same kind of thing that happens. Cheap foreign grain makes the small farmer struggle. Rich men bought up large portions of the farmer's land. Number three, the rich men, those that had the money, as they would see these farmers struggle, they would buy up large portions of their land. Another thing that, let me give you a second just to, okay, another thing that happens as well is this new phenomena begins of instead of using laborers from the land, they begin using laborers who are POWs, slaves. And rather than hire workers, we'd have a good thing we never did that in America because we'd be really creeps, right? I mean, we did the same thing. You remember in the early stages of we started off with indentured servants. People would come over and they would, the deal would be, okay, Tony, you're living in England, you don't have any, you want to come to America, you don't have any money. I am a rich plantation owner in Virginia, I grow tobacco. I will pay for you, Tony, to come over and I will give you, I will put you up on my farm, you will work for me, you'll be my servant for 7 years. After 7 years, you are free to go and you will get a portion of land. And you'll be free. Hey, good deal, right? The only problem, yeah, right. What are you pointing at?
The Appalachian.
Exactly. Well, why? What do you know about that?
You told us that.
Oh, I did. That's one of my favorite stories because that's one of the big ripoffs that we've ever pulled in this country. All the rich plantation owners owned all of this land right here near the stinking coast. Beautiful land, huge. You ever see these gigantic plantations in the movies? You know. Huge, miles and miles of beautiful, not a tree on the land. Beautiful farmland, right? Finally, this indentured servant gets done his 7 years. Guess where he gets? Backcountry. It's called the backcountry. Right here, kissing up against the Appalachian Mountains, where he's literally got to plant his crops around trees. It's like terrible land. And there were lots of rebellions in the, you know, Shays Rebellion and other rebellions in the early stages of this the country because of that kind of stuff. But anyway... So we did the same thing in our country. So it was a problem that they begin using slave labor. They realize, hey, it's cheaper to buy a slave and work him to death all his life than to pay a servant. So as a result, you have a lot of unemployed people. The next factor is because slave labor is used, destitute farmers move to the cities. By the way, boy, I'll tell you, if you know about history, you just see this stuff happen over and over again. This is the story of the Middle Ages. This is the story of how cities were founded in the late Middle Ages. This is also the story of the Industrial Revolution in almost every country in the world. The Industrial Revolution started and all the artisans who lived in the cities, you know, the man would grow crops and the wife would sit home and make rugs. And then this is the Middle Ages, and they would go out with baskets of food and they would say, okay, Tony, you grow potatoes, I grow turnips. I'll trade you half a bushel of turnips for half a bushel of potatoes. And you say, okay. And then one woman goes to another woman who makes dresses, and she says, I made this rug. I'll trade you this rug for two of your new dresses. And they bartered like that. That's the manorial society, feudalism. That's what it was all about. Now the thing is, guess what happens when people invent this thing called machines? And all of a sudden it's cheaper to go out and buy a dress that's been made off one of these machines for pennies than to buy her dress that she spent 30, 40 hours making. What happens? There's no more, there isn't any market left for the artisans. So guess what happens? Guess what all of the people in the outskirts do? They move to the cities and they work in factories. That's the story of New England too, folks. I mean, all of the textile mills and... okay, so I mean, if you know history, you see these cycles happening all the time. So they all move into the city. Now, you have a city at this point full of what? Unemployed men. Groveling, complaining. Oh, yeah, I'll tell you the problem with the... Why am I talking like an Englishman? This is Rome. I'll tell you this problem with the Roman Empire. Although they weren't really Italians the way we think of them. But they're complaining, and the government's got to do something. What are the patricians going to do to appease the plebes? Does anybody know? Very famous term in history, bread and circuses. You ever hear that before? That term, bread and circuses. They give them bread and they give them circuses. You know what we'll do? We'll give them some bread so they won't complain they didn't eat today. Number one, bread's cheap. And number two, we'll give them entertainment. Hey, let's go to the circus. Our life is miserable. So here's what these unemployed bums did. They would eat bread and they would go to the circuses where they would see anywhere from 4,000 to 5,000 men and beasts killed every day. The circus. You know what the circus? You know what the circus was? The Roman idea of a circus was not the American idea. It wasn't Barnum and Bailey, you know, training the lions. The lions weren't tame in those days. It was, you know, lions five, Christians nothing, that kind of deal. The idea was that's in the late. They're not going against Christians yet. That's later. You know, I don't want to jump too far ahead. We're still in the Republic. But they would have gladiatorial matches, the gladiators. Men would fight against men. Men would fight against beasts. Usually these men, a lot of them were slaves. A lot of them were, in the later days, by the way, you know, they had a thing called the Valarium. And when they built the Colosseum in Rome, and I'll show you pictures of that. When they built the Colosseum in Rome, it was absolutely huge, gigantic. And I mean, the things they did there, it's unbelievable. But they had a velarium, which was basically a top, a canvas kind of top, you know, for the, and you can still see the holes. You'll see it in the show that I'm going to show you next week. But they put this velarium on. At the end of the day, the entire place ranked of the smell of blood. It was so profuse that all you could smell is this ghastly stench of blood. Thing after thing after thing after thing died. It was like, and you know, you ever see Thumbs Down? You know where that comes from, right?
Yeah, when they would watch the thing and whoever would win or lose.
Well, let's say somebody lost and they had
awful.
You know, the guys on the ground, that would have been me, definitely. No doubt about it, on the ground. Oh boy, what a way to go. And they're looking around, and then the emperor would usually look around and the people would give the sign. If they went like this, they were saying he was a good fighter, spare his life. You know, he was a good fighter. If they don't think he gave them their money's worth, which was nothing, this is welfare circuses, folks. You almost they would have think that it would have been cheaper just to get them jobs, you know. Make a new Colosseum, okay? Come and see us when you're done, we'll pay you. And then just move while they're building it. If they didn't think they'd get their money's worth, it was thumbs down. And that's where that comes from. And at that point, it would be... You know, they'd get the sword or whatever. Okay? All right, so these are the problems that are happening. Everybody's moving into the cities. You get the idea? Okay? Latins come. Latins, right? Latins come. They wipe out the Etruscans. I'm reviewing. They wipe out the Etruscans. They form a league with the Latins. They conquer all of the Latins. They go down to Magna Graecia. The Greeks in Magna Graecia, which is Sicily and southern Italy, call to Pyrrhus for help. They say, please help us, King Pyrrhus. Pyrrhus comes over, loses most of his army, but wins a couple battles. Finally, they end up losing. They're in charge of the entire country now. Now, Rome is the most powerful of all the little city-states that are in Athens, okay? I mean, that are in that are in Italy. Okay? Eventually, commercial trade is going well and the agricultural trade is going well, but the division, the wedge between the classes gets deeper and deeper and deeper all the time. The plebes are getting farther apart from the patricians. The patricians are making more decisions that have nothing to do with the plebes. They're not putting having the plebes in mind at all. They're serving themselves. And this is, you know what else? If you know history again, the same thing happens. Anybody know where? About the 1780s, 1789?
France.
France. Oh, yeah. You kidding me? There were three estates in France. The first estate was the priests. The second estates was the nobility. And the third estates was everybody else. Same deal. And eventually they said, we've had enough of this. In the French Revolution, they heard this thing happen. Louis XVI was married to this woman who was a foreigner named Marie Antoinette. And Marie Antoinette was quite a dame. She's got quite a story to go behind her. But the main thing is, supposedly one day, and this is probably apocryphal and probably never happened, but one day, somebody commented to Marie Antoinette, Marie, are you not distressed? The people have no bread to eat. And what did she say? What is it?
Let them eat cake.
You get the idea? Obviously, now this got to the people. And the people heard that the queen said this. They don't have any bread. These people are watching their kids starve. And this woman says, oh, they don't have any bread. Let them eat cake. I have plenty of cake. So they flip out and they basically, it probably never happened. They flip out and they storm the Bastille. And you know the story of the French Revolution, don't you? They storm the Bastille. But the main thing about the French Revolution is it didn't have a Reformation base. It had a base of humanism, and Voltaire's philosophies, who was an atheist, and he came violently against Christianity. He said, God, what a ridiculous concept. This Jesus who teaches people to be poor, spend their lives being poor and being nothing, so that they'll get reward in the afterworld, it's ridiculous. He said blasphemous things like that, that God is cruel and ridiculous to play jokes on man like he does, and all kinds of things like this. Now, that was the base of the French Revolution. In the American Revolution, which was a different kind of revolution, in fact, I very seldomly call it a revolution, I call it the American War for Independence, it had a Reformation base. It honored God in its decisions. And the bottom line, what happened is God blessed one, and the French Revolution was a bloodbath, an absolute bloodbath. I'll give you an example. They're going to trade a bad monarchy, which they had. Louis XVI was a bad king, but they exchange a bad monarchy for a horrible dictator. And Napoleon Bonaparte is going to come to prominence. I don't remember the numbers, but I believe it's 186,000 men are going to die in his campaign against Russia. They're going to freeze to death. 186,000 men. Now, I want you to think about that, folks. The Providence Civic Center holds about 10,000. 186,000 men. So that's what? Is that 186 Providence Civic Centers? Isn't that what it would be? Is that right?
Well,
no, it can't be. You just moved the decimal point. Have to be, I think it would be 186 Providence Civic Centers.
Look, you had 10.
186,000. All right, that's right. It would be 1,000. All right. So it would be 18.6. 18.6 Providence, filled with soldiers in one campaign and going to freeze to death. There's going to be a guy by the name of Robespierre that comes along. And see, here's what happens, okay? Here's what happens in a humanistic base now. Not a Reformation base, but in a humanistic base, here's what happens. You understand what I mean about the base? The reason, like the underlying philosophy behind the revolution? Okay. What happens is this, folks. In the French Revolution, and with a humanistic base, they're going to overthrow the government, and then they're going to kill anybody that disagrees with the government. You see what I mean? They're not going to bring in freedom. They're going to bring in tyranny, only of a different flavor. So they're going to kill everyone. They put this guy in charge of it called Robespierre, who's a bloodthirsty, maniacal, super evil genius. And what he does is, he does things like he'll take 3,000 men, put them on a barge, put it in the middle of the ocean and sink it. Things like that. That's what they trade. That's what the French Revolution is all about. It's about tyranny. It's about the very worst of everything that happens when we rely on humanism. And yet, look at the American War for Independence. Much different story. What about the war that takes place in 1688 in England? The English Civil War? It's called the Bloodless Revolution. You know why? It had a Reformation base and hardly anyone got killed. The Bloodless Revolution, the Glorious Revolution, it's called. All right, enough about that. Blood in circuses. Bread in circuses, I mean. They give them bread and they give them circuses, okay? Now, so we can see the problem that we have in Rome. Now, there is going to be a... I'll tell you what we'll do here. We'll talk a little bit about this. I'm going to keep you just a few minutes longer. We'll go for a break. We'll come back. We'll do the three Punic Wars, and then we'll leave. We'll come back next time, and we'll pick up with Julius Caesar crossing the Rubicon, the Roman Empire, and that'll bring us to the end. We'll have covered the whole thing, okay? Let me just talk for a moment about when these things begin to happen now. By the way, however, the money that the plebs have is going to win them some concessions. And they begin to pick up some small victories. And although they're small at first, they become more and more pronounced and more greater, larger all the time. The biggest victory that they come up with is they're able to get their own assembly, which is called the Consilium Plebis. They come up with their own assembly. Remember how we have the assembly of the patricians and then the Senate? Well, the plebs now, the common folk, the 90%, come up with the Consilium Plebis. Plebis, like this. And this is the Pleban Assembly. And they, rather than elect... What did the other group elect? Consuls. These guys are going to elect, they elect tribunes. They elect tribunes. At first, they elect two. Then later, they elect 10 tribunes for 1 year periods. Another concession that they got, so this is one. These are, let's call them Pleban victories. Another concession that they got was the law of 12 tables. The law of 12 tables. Very, very important in history. You know, I mean, we have to cover it. I've got to give you this stuff or we wouldn't be doing justice to what happened, and even in the thumbnail coverage of the Roman Empire. The Law of the 12 Tables is the plebeians came along and they demanded that all of these laws that they didn't really know what they were, you know what I mean? In other words, there were lots of laws that the patricians had made, but the plebeians didn't know those laws. And unless they know the law, then they can't know how to effectively oppose the law or how to get over. You see what I mean? So they demanded that the laws be written on 12 tablets of gold and be placed in the forum, which was the central meeting place in Rome. So the law of the 12 tables is simply this. The writing of the previously unwritten laws onto 12 golden tablets. Actually writing down these laws. Actually writing down these laws. Okay? All right, now let's continue and let's just finish this last thing up here. What happens as a result, folks, is first there's something called the Gracchi rebellion or revolution. I'm not going to hold you to that. Let me just tell you what it is very quickly. There are these two brothers. Their last name is Gracchi or Gracchus. And what happens is they get elected into the Senate and they begin making concessions for the poor. They begin to make, they say, we ought to division all the land and give land to the poor, that kind of thing, okay? Well, one of the brothers ends up getting killed, and the other brother, who takes over his work after him, continues to work for the poor to, you know, to try to help and alleviate them. He is rejected by the councils and all this, and he ends up killing himself. But the Gracchi Rebellion is important for one thing. The reason it's so important is that it begins to put this revolutionary mindset into the mind of the plebs. It puts this revolutionary mentality in the mind of the plebs. They begin thinking of, yeah, you know what? We should have some land. Hey, you know what? Things aren't right. Hey, this isn't right. How come we don't get this? And how come you guys get that? And all of this business, okay? So, that's what happens. Now, as a result of that, a full-blown civil war breaks out. And we've got to talk to you about these guys. And then we'll quit here for a break. Come back with the three Punic Wars, which are really a blast. And then we'll let you guys go, okay? We'll have accomplished our objective for tonight, I think. Okay, here are the guys. There are two guys. One is called Sulla. And one is called Marius. These guys go to, a civil war breaks out in Rome, and these two gentlemen are going to be the guys who lead up the major armies in opposition to one another, okay? All right, so let me give you a couple of little points here under these guys. Marius was favored by the tribunal assembly. Sulla was favored by the Senate. So immediately we know one thing. Who's he fighting for? the patricians. He's fighting for the patricians. Okay? Or let's call them the Pats, because they lose. And these guys are fighting for, and he's fighting for the plebs. Marius is fighting for the plebs. Okay? Now, you have got to, this is like an impossible thing to keep straight. So just listen to this. Let me tell you how this happens. It's this incredible story, folks, of how this happens. What's that? What's that? Well, no, these are my notes on the side. See how I have them broken down? I have like Sulla, because when I teach, these books are okay, but they're really very, very vague. They'll just kind of tell you, you know, this guy does this, and so I write, you know, my own notes for my study so that when I lecture, I don't need three books or something like that. Okay, here's what happens. Sulla is favored by the rich and by the Senate. He's a proven warrior. He has put down revolts before. He's chosen to, he was chosen to put down a revolt in Asia Minor. Marius is favored by the poor tribunal assembly. He's a proven warrior as well. He's fought in North Africa and he's fought in Gaul. Now here's what happens. The war takes place and Sulla beats Marius. Sulla beats Marius. So the Senate's army wins. Okay? But what happens is there's a problem immediately in Asia. And so they have to send Sulla to Asia to put down this revolt over there. Now guess what happens while Sulla's gone? Marius comes back, right? And he returns with his army. They enter Rome in 87 BC and they massacre the Senate. They come in and they massacre not all of the Senate, but most of the Senate's supporters, all those who had supported Sulla. They come in and they massacre them. Well, Marius and his cohort, Marius has this friend by the name of Cinna, C-I-N-N-A. Okay, he's like his right, Cinna is like Marius' right-hand man. Now watch how confusing this gets and how absolutely, I mean it's like a fairy tale to even imagine this kind of thing. We've got some kind of government in order here, okay? So you got one guy, two armies go to war, civil war, okay? Marius is chased out. Sulla has to go to Asia, so Marius comes back in, wipes out the Senate, or all of the senatorial supporters, okay? Now, so here's Marius, and he's in the city, and he's got this guy by the name of Cinna, who's his pal, and they're kind of ruling together, okay? Now, watch this. Marius and Cinna proclaim themselves consuls without an election. Now, there's already a big breakdown in the system. This is dictatorship, folks, right? They proclaim themselves to be consuls without even an election. Marius, however, dies pretty soon afterward. So now only Cinna is left. So Cinna is in the city, remaining in the city,